Okay, I'll call to order the Committee on Veterans Affairs for the 1st of March 2011. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3205. Read the bill, please.
House Bill 3205 creates the Oregon Veterans Business Enterprise Program to provide funding for veterans starting a new business or expanding an existing business.
Now, do we have anyone else besides me that's going to discuss this? Okay, we have first in the queue Val Connolly and Mac McDonald.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Connolly. I am the Veterans Services Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I am here today to provide information regarding the Oregon Business Enterprise Program. This is not a new concept to come before the legislature, and it is one that the department has supported in the past. The Business Enterprise Program would provide veterans financial assistance to help vets start a new business or expand an existing business. Given the high rate of veteran unemployment, as much as three times the state average in parts of the state, the department believes that helping vets start a business or expand an existing business in a limited way could help lower those unemployment numbers. Given the economic environment the state is currently in, the department does not support funding this program and supports amending the bill to eliminate the appropriation. However, should the legislature pass this bill without an appropriation, it would allow ODVA to establish the administrative rules for the program for a time when there may be funding available, and we would at that time be ready to help our entrepreneurial veterans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I think we'll wait until after Mac's done, and then we'll get the panel as a whole. Go ahead, Mac.
My name is Mac McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. This bill is a good bill. Basically, what it does is establish the small enterprise system, and so ODVA, when the time when Oregon has some money, if the program's already established, they can put it in their budget. And I support the amendment to delete the funds from this bill.
Okay, thanks. Any questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What did we do in 2009? Wasn't there a similar bill that we set something up for entrepreneurial veterans returning home?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Huffman, we had a small business repair loan program. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you follow up?
Sure.
I'm sorry, Val. Can you expand on that? You're right, and I remember
yes.
That if you could.
And that was a program for veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who had a small business when they were deployed, and as a result of their deployment, their business suffered. So when they came back, they would be eligible for a small business repair loan at 0% interest.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And what has happened to that program? Did we do something with it in 2010 because of lack of participation or something?
I believe due to...
lack of money.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Mac.
Due to budget cuts, that
Mac McDonald
program was defunded.
We ran out of money, basically. It was a very active program. The veterans took advantage of it, and very quickly we ran out of money.
Okay.
But in today's environment, we don't feel that the state can really afford to put money into this program at this time. But we want to have the program available so at a later time when the state does have some money, the ODVA can put it in their budget. and budget for this support of this program.
Okay, thank you.
Representative?
No, he just answered the question. Thank you.
Any other questions?
None at all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else would like to comment on 3205? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3205. Open up a work session for the amendment only. Work session on 3205. You have a dash one amendment in front of you, which basically takes out the fiscal on it, if my memory serves me correct, and it allocates the ability of the Oregon Department of Veterans to find other funding for this so it does not come out of the state general fund coffers. Does everyone have that?
No. Mr. Chair, do you have another copy?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Real simple fix.
Okay. I can't keep
it. Sorry.
Budget statements, Mr. Chair.
budgetary crunch.
So this is SharePoint.
That's right. Now, I'll take a moment. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3205.
Okay, it's been moved by Representative Matthews to attach the addendum of the dash one amendments to 3205. Any objection? Seeing none, so be it. Close the work session on 3205. Open up a public hearing on 3206. In the queue on 3206 is Mac McDonald. And you have to read it. Go ahead.
House Bill 3206 increases the tax credit for TRICARE providers from $1,000 to $5,000, and this is in the section that pertains to TRICARE providers who are already who already have TRICARE patients.
Matt.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. Basically, we have problems in rural Oregon getting doctors to accept TRICARE. And this is aimed primarily at getting those doctors to accept TRICARE in situations and areas where we have problems.
Any questions of Mac? I'd like to make a statement on this, and it is true. In TRICARE, which is from people that have served in the military for as a career, they are allowed to use their TRICARE, I believe. They pay so much a month for that, but the problem we see is that it isn't paying enough for rural doctors and so on and so forth to see the patients, so therefore we're trying to get it to where they can, in fact, have more of an opportunity to go to those doctors in rural Oregon. Yes, Representative.
This bill, though, doesn't just apply to rural Oregon, as I'm reading it. Is that correct?
It's Oregon.
Yes, well, that's good because this is a problem also in metro Oregon with getting people who are willing to take TRICARE as insurance. I've been through that a lot of times. So, okay. Or you have doctors who just drop you because they finally decide it's not viable anymore.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Mac, have we checked with the medical community to make sure this is something that will make a difference, that they'll participate in?
I've asked two or three doctors about it, and they said it will help. And we'll just have to wait and see as far as whether they accept us or not. But we really do have a problem with this. And what it does, if we don't get doctors to accept it, those people that are under TRICARE will have to go to another insurance, and it's a cost out of their pocket that shouldn't be, because TRICARE has been set forth by the federal government as the insurance for those people that have been in the military and retired or disabled.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on 3206. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3207. We have in the queue Mac McDonald, Scott Winkle, and Mike Ilson. Ilson? Correct.
Ilson.
You'll come up, please.
House Bill 3207 requires a public employer to interview every veteran applicant for a position who meets all the qualifying criteria for that position.
Okay, start her off, Mac.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. What this bill does is help the veteran unemployment. The veteran unemployment in this state is three times the current unemployment in this state. I would make one change to the bill on line six. Before veteran, I'd put Oregon veteran in there, so it covers just the veterans from the state of Oregon. But other than that, this is to lower our unemployment in our veterans population. And we feel by getting an interview, some veterans or some people, not only veterans, don't do well on tests, but they do excellent when they're before an interview board. And this gives them a chance to shine and a chance for a job.
Scott?
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt. For the record, Scott Winkle is representing the League of Oregon Cities. First off, I would like to say that the League of Oregon Cities and the cities and city governments across the state are very pleased that so many veterans choose to apply for employment with city government. There are a number of positions that are physically demanding, can be physically dangerous, not just in the public safety career field. And by and large, what we see when veterans apply for city jobs is that they show up, they're ready to work. We don't have problems with drug tests. These are, by and large, very desirable employees for city governments. However, we do have some concerns over this legislation. Under the current statutes, at every point during a hiring process, the city applies a preference to a veteran application, whether it's points on an application or if they're not using a point system, they'll find some other way to apply a preference to that candidate. If after applying the preference to that candidate, that candidate still doesn't make your top 10 list, say you're only going to interview 10 employees, to tell that applicant that they're going to be included in the interview batch doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to increase their chance to get a position with the city. I would also add that in some instances, there are certain things that, while maybe not included in the minimum qualifications, will eliminate a candidate from consideration for certain public safety jobs. For instance, a couple of Class A traffic violations, and they're probably not going to get hired for a position with city government for obvious reasons, even though that's not one of the immediate disqualifiers from those positions. Additionally, for certain positions, we could easily have well over 800 applications coming in for a series of positions if you're doing a pool hiring for police officers. A city could find itself easily in a position of interviewing 100 candidates, even though those candidates may not necessarily have be competitive along the way. And I also pulled off a job announcement from the city of Gold Beach. City of Gold Beach is currently hiring a police chief for the state. And the minimum qualifications are equivalents of a two-year degree, 5 years increasing responsibilities as a public safety officer, and some supervisory experience. The desired qualifications are a four-year degree, certification, executive certification through DPSST, experience at the lieutenant level and rank. I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to suggest that the person who gets this job is going to have those desired qualifications. That's who they're going to hire, is the person who has that degree, who has the certifications, who has the experience at the command level, law enforcement. To interview a person at the minimum qualifications, I would suggest, does create a sense of false hopes for that particular position. We are eager to work with the Department of Veterans Affairs to find out if people are indeed qualified for people who are not getting interviews that ought to get interviews, who are competitive for positions, and we are eager to find ways to reduce veterans' unemployment. But I would also add that a large portion of the membership of the League of Oregon Cities are in hiring freezes right now. So currently there's not a lot of the positions in the Oregon City within cities is probably not going to have a significant impact on unemployment rates across the board. And with that, I'm eager for the committee's questions.
Thank you, Co-Chair Esquivel. My name is Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I would share actually many of Mr. Winkle's comments. We've been hearing from a number of counties, all of whom say that we should be trying to do everything we can to make situations better for returning veterans. The only thing that they have mentioned in a couple of occasions is that we have beefed up veterans' preference over the last few years, and they have instituted, I think, from what we're hearing, fairly robust preferences. And they've noted that the breadth of this legislation means that, for instance, if a road crew is hiring an entry-level position, there aren't necessarily a lot of minimum requirements. They could easily be getting hundreds of applicants in this economy, and they could be doing interviews for 2 months for an entry-level position. On the flip side, bringing in folks for executive level positions where they pay to, for instance, fly people in, although with the change that Mr. McDonald mentioned putting in Oregon, that may be not an issue at this time. But I think the main concern that we've been hearing back from counties is that the breadth of this would potentially require incredibly lengthy interview processes. That said, we want to try to do everything we can for veterans. And as Mr. Winkle said, if the preference isn't working right now, we'd like to look at other ways we can help. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes.
Is there, and this is just, I don't know if anybody has the answer, is there language that describes what civil service positions are? I don't think of rogue, when I think civil service, I don't think rogue crew. But I'd like some clarification for my own purposes on what we think those are, if there's language that defines that somewhere in a statute.
Mr. Winkle?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Parrish, in 4225, there is a definition of civil service that is unique to that section of the ORS, which defines it as essentially any public employment. That actually created a little bit of confusion among when the preferences were originally passed back in the 07 session, because when you say civil service to a human resources professional, you're usually speaking to a very specific type of position, a specific type of hiring processes that, frankly, most local governments don't use. But it is broadly defined within 4225. Excuse me. I gave you the wrong citation. It's 408225.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, I was wondering if the League might possibly have an amendment that would enable us to, all of us, to get to yes on this bill.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, I did have a conversation with Mac. Sorry, your last name?
McDonald.
Mr. McDonald.
That's why we call him Mac.
Yes, sir. I did have a conversation. I do appreciate him adding the word Oregon in there to deal with having to fly candidates in. I would very much like to get to yes. I'm going to have to bring in some of my HR folks to figure out what that is and also figure out what else we can do to alleviate the issue. For instance, I don't know that Department of Veterans Affairs, when they do reintegration programs, are they notifying people of the League of Oregon City's job site, which is a complete list of jobs around the state and local government, or helping people who are in service know what they need to do if they want to be a police officer or a firefighter to keep their driving record and credit histories clean and those sorts of things. So we want to get to yes on this, and we will do what we can to make that happen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for that, and certainly appreciate your efforts in that regard.
Mr. Chairman. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Matthews.
For Mr. Winkle, for Mr. Lassen. I'm curious, have you thought about putting a cap at the applicants, not veteran applicants, but applicants in general? And the reason I ask is, City of Gresham, firefighter jobs are hard to come by. Very popular, people put in for them, a lot of kids going to school, a lot of people want them. Rather than getting 800, 900, 1,200 applicants, they say 300 applicants. It closes in a day and a half. Have you thought about that from an agency standpoint, so that you're not, you know, I mean, you should just assume that whatever you put the cap at, that's who will apply. And if they meet the minimum qualification, you would interview those people anyway. So have you thought about that aspect of it?
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Matthews, that had not occurred to me in this. I was, I know that some larger cities do cap out their applications. We hadn't thought about it in this for the smaller, the mid-sized cities. But I can take that up with our HR folks.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Matthews. That's a good point, and we hadn't exactly thought of that. Positions differ greatly, so I think that would make sense for some positions. And then counties differ greatly. So, but that's definitely something that we'd consider.
Follow, Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. Thank you, sir. And my point, you mentioned a point about law enforcement officials, somebody applying, you know, executive officer position, let's just assume chief, that you didn't know, but you could assume that that four-year degree holder would probably get that position. And let's just be realistic. I mean, not everybody that has an education has the most common sense. Got a lot of soldiers out there that are incredible leaders at every level and every rank that don't necessarily have to have a piece of paper to do that leadership in our community. And I would just say that, and I wouldn't assume that any four-year degree beats out any of that experience.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and very good point there, Representative Matthews. I guess, you know, one of the questions I always ask is there a problem that we're trying to fix? And so, Mac, the question would be to you, have veterans groups come out and said that we do have a problem with veterans not getting interviews?
United Veterans Bargain, which Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hoffman, United Veterans Bargain meets once a quarter, and this was brought up by two different veterans organizations saying, we have people that are qualified, but they're not getting interviews. And they, while they don't do well on written tests, the interview would really help them. But the big problem here is we have three times the number of veterans that are unemployed, and we need to get them into the employed field so they become citizens of Oregon that pay taxes. And this is just one method of getting them some employment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to Representative Matthews' point, co-chairs, Representative Matthews, your point is well taken. And point of fact, in some cities, Portland comes to mind as the largest, but I know in other jurisdictions, 2 years of military service would also substitute for the 60-hour education requirement. So yes, you were right; that is very valuable experience. For the point, but my point was is that the person who's going to be most competitive is going to have the not just the degree, but also the executive is holding the executive certification, for instance, an existing police chief or someone who already has that the necessary certifications for the position. But we do, you're correct in that experience is vital and it is very valuable, and we do recognize that within the hiring process.
That's Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I'm looking at 408.225 and A, the definition of a civil service position. The way I read this, I don't read it to say that this is open to the folks who would be a road crew. And specifically, civil service position means any position for which a hiring or promotion decision is made or required to be made on the basis of a results of merit-based competitive process that includes but is not limited to consideration of an applicant's or employee's relative ability, knowledge, experience, or other skills. Why I would dispute that might actually limit some jobs is when you're talking about promotion as being a result of a merit-based. We've got a lot of systems, particularly in some of the collective bargaining contracts, where promotion wouldn't be merit-based at all. That would actually lead me to believe that these types of jobs that maybe we're talking about in this are actually more managerial positions and not road crew positions, just reading the definition of what we've got in here as a civil servant.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Representative Parrish. It was our understanding that the intent of the law when the veterans preference was put into place was that it was to apply to all positions. And then there was a question because many, at least in many counties, positions were not necessarily considered civil service positions. But with some clarification, it was an understanding that that basically that veterans preference would apply to all positions that were being advertised and open. And so that's the understanding that I'm working from. At this time, if it's possible that you know a road public works position is not part of that, then I'm mistaken. But I do believe that the intent of the veterans preference law was to apply to all positions.
Okay with that, Representative?
Yeah, I mean I just think we probably need to at some point revisit that language
because
it's really funky.
Any further questions? Comments?
Just, if you don't mind. Thank you. And this speaks to, thank you, Mr. Chair. This speaks to something we saw down in Portland when they had the Veterans Day and they came down there and I forget, I wish I could remember the name of that, but the city came together and they had a group of folks and all the veterans assembled and I had talked to a lieutenant colonel at that point that had served in the Pentagon. And quite honestly, he had a bunch of certifications. He didn't have anything specific to law enforcement or fire. But a lot of certifications and a lot of leadership positions, and he had held many offices. But he just didn't know how to put that onto a piece of paper that would mean something to somebody that was perhaps disconnected from service, that didn't realize what it meant to be a commanding officer of a certain brigade or whatnot. And I think that we just have a ways to go in this. I mean, with all of this that we're talking about, comes an educational component as well, that we've got to get out and we've got to educate our employers, our veterans, all of our commanding officers, and to let them know what's available out there and what we're going to do about it. Because ultimately, if we can't provide the training that gets that veteran to put their experience on paper to matter to somebody who's reading it, they're never going to really get that fair shot because nobody can translate what it means to be a colonel at the Pentagon. What's that? That could be the same as security guard at Walmart. They just don't know. And quite honestly, that position that colonel held that I was talking to him about, I was just amazed. And yet he couldn't get an interview with anybody because he couldn't get past the process. Very frustrating. And nobody's blaming you. Nobody's blaming, you know, military. It's just, it's all of ours to fix. And I'm just glad to see that Oregon has taken that effort to do so.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to get off track, but before I lose my train of thought, I do want to tie in here. And I think I have a priority bill left, and I would be more than happy to work with the committee in a continuing effort to what Mac's working on here. I have talked to, in the past, community colleges, and along with what Representative Matthews is talking about, a lot of us that have been in the military have no college credit to show for weeks in military police training and on and on and on, and officer training and other things like that. And I would really like to see this state, and I don't know where the go button is on this idea, but I would really like to be able to put together a plan where Oregon's higher ed system could apply credit hours to certain military training aspects and give a vet a jump start when he gets out of the military. He could go to a community college and pay, you know, $15 per credit hour, some reduced rate since there wouldn't be any seat time, and have those credit hours applied to his experiential credit and give him a jump start. And, you know, who knows, we may have veterans come out with 20 or 25 hours that they didn't know they had otherwise because they were accumulated but not, sir?
Not recognized.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mac.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, there is a Senate bill doing exactly
that
right
now. Please identify yourself again,
Mac. Matt McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. There's a Senate bill, I think it's 725 right now, that's doing exactly that. Community colleges are giving credit based on a national accreditation pamphlet that's accepted by community colleges throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So people in the service will get credit for their service and what they did in the service at a community college level.
That would be great.
Absolutely. Any other comments or questions? I would like to say one thing. The biggest offender that we found that do not comply with the law is the government. I would like you two to get with MAC and bring in a solution. Don't bring just a problem. Bring in a solution. And we will see you in about a week or two, if that's okay. Did you think you can get to that crossroad?
Co-Chair Esquivel, we'll do everything we can to.
That is what I ask.
Representative Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, I think we can find something that will work. We will do our best, level best, to do so.
Okay, very good. So we will see you in probably a couple of weeks. How does that sound? Is that okay with everyone?
Okay. Thank you.
And I do want to add one thing. You make the criteria in your own organizations of what the cutoff is, so I really don't see the problem. I think you're making a problem up that doesn't exist. You have the standard. That's the minimum criteria. If you have 500 people and you're only taking the first 25, that's the standard. So please explain to me, if you would, why it's a problem.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, the minimum qualifications for some positions are not always the determination of the city government. There are positions within law enforcement and public safety where the minimum standards are set: GED, 21 years of age, hasn't committed certain felonies, and ability to hold a certification. The minimum qualifications and the desirable qualifications aren't always going to match. And it also depends on who applies for the position, so it does become somewhat subjective in that if you have a hiring process and you end up getting a whole bunch of people who are already employed in the career field who are transferring in because your pay scale is higher in a particular government, it changes who's going to be the most competitive candidate for the position. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Well, yeah, you are and you aren't. And the reason I'm saying this is because if you know that, like Representative Matthews saying, okay, we cut it off at 300 applicants. Well, couldn't you have a criteria that you posted that may be higher than the minimum? And that would be your minimum? Isn't that what you actually do when you have 500 applicants? You don't go through all 500. You go through a select few that scored the highest or whatever. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Esquivel, if I understand your point correctly, if you were to do that and created a higher standard, then to Representative Matthews' point, you may have someone who on paper may not may not meet that desirable qualification, but maybe someone you would want to talk to. There's something that they do something that helps them stand out in the interview process that you may end up shunting away who may have been a very good candidate.
Okay, very good. Okay. You'll get together, all three of you get together and come back?
Sure.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Anyone else would like to? That looks like my friend. And co-veteran.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I could say something, maybe yes. Give a directive here. If I could get Tom to look up that Senate bill, it wasn't 725, but I think this committee would be extremely interested in that bill.
Well, that's why I'm here, Representative Huffman.
Oh, thank you, Director.
Wait a minute. We have, this is like baseball. We have all kinds of signs here in the back. Director Willis.
Yes.
Steal home.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee. Senate Bill 275 is the one you're looking for. He just transposed the numbers there. And that will, we've already testified on the Senate side on this bill. If that bill is passed, it will move us light years forward in terms of giving college credit to our military members for their, both their military schools and their military service. And it's about time. It's a good thing. So that's, I just want to do a clarification on Senate Bill 275. And co-chairs and members of the committee and Representative Parrish, to your issue, which was, I believe, 408-230, Senate Bill 277 addresses that issue.
Okay.
And what has happened with regard to veterans' preference, although we thought the law was very clear, there was some misunderstanding in various components of government, state, county, and municipal, for that matter, about when does this veterans' preference apply and when doesn't it. In our view, the 5% for the veteran and the five points for the veteran and the 10 points for the disabled veteran, which by rule of this body is now a lifetime benefit,
mm-hmm.
Is very clear. It applies when you apply for a job in the government sector at any level. Well, apparently that wasn't clear enough. So when you see Senate Bill 277, you'll see specific language that addresses the exact issue that you just raised. And I wanted to let you know it's on its way. So there's two times that issues have been brought up today by this committee where the answer is on its way. I just wish this would happen more often, but unfortunately it doesn't. But in this case...
I hate to interrupt you, but just for the record, could you tell us who you are?
Oh, yes, sir, I can. I'm Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
We all know it, but
you have to. I know, we have to put it in the record, yes, sir. In any event, I just wanted to clarify that, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, but this was just for clarification.
Any questions of Director Willis? Thanks,
thank you,
Director
sir.
Willis.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Anyone else would like to comment on House Bill 3207? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3207. Go to work session, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2241. So, would you read it, please?
House Bill 2241 broadens the definition of uniformed service for employment protection to match the federal definition under ERISA, adds initial active duty for training as type of military leave for which public employee may take a leave of absence. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage, and there is no subsequent referral.
So I'll entertain a motion. Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2241 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and there is no subsequent referral, so I move 2241, due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Matthews has moved House Bill 2241 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Seeing none, so be it. Do we think we need that on a consent calendar, or do we just need to have someone pack it to explain it? I think we better explain it. Okay. Representative Matthews? Thank you. Okay, I will.
We have the informational, too. Are you going to do that at the end?
Yeah, we'll do it after this.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to have a work session on House Bill 2204. I'll open it up. 2402, I'm sorry.
House Bill 2402 is an appropriation bill for money to the Campus Veterans Service Officers Program for the biennium. This has an emergency clause. It's effective on passage and subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, this does have a fiscal on it. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The Department of Veterans Affairs have very much wanted to see this to the end. So,
mm-hmm.
And take a motion. Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2402 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Matthews has moved House Bill 2402 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any objections? Seeing none? So pass.
I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2403.
House Bill 2403 requires state agencies to partner with the Oregon Military Department to provide reintegration services to veterans. This has an emergency clause. It's effective on passage, and there is no subsequent referral.
Okay. Entertain a motion on that.
Representative
Matthews, you're still on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2403 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Matthews has moved House Bill 2403 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Any comments? Seeing none, so be it. Close House Bill 20, the work session on House Bill 2403.
We need to carry it.
Okay. Now, who would like to carry that? Anyone like to carry it?
I'll go.
I'm happy to carry it.
Representative Parrish, you're on. Yeah, I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2404.
House Bill 2404 creates a tax credit for mental health professionals who provide services to veterans. This has an emergency clause. It takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sin die. This has a subsequent referral to tax credits, and it also has a dash one amendment that has not yet been adopted.
Hmm. So I guess I need a we have to get the dash one amendments on it as first of all, so go ahead and do that.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Matthews.
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2404.
Representative Matthews has moved Amendment 1 to House Bill 2404. Any comment? Any objection? So moved. Okay, I'll make need a go ahead. And
Mr. Chair, our SharePoint's broken.
Are you having problems with today?
Being on the end.
Okay. So now I need a motion to move the amendment to the floor with the subsequent referral.
Want to try
it again, Representative Matthews?
We'll give it a go. I move House Bill 2404 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Tax Credits.
Representative Matthews has moved 2404 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation for the referral to the Tax Credit Committee. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved. Close the hearing on the work session on 2404. Open up the work session on House Bill 2919.
House Bill 2919 extends grant eligibility for hiring veterans under the Building Opportunities for Oregon Small Business Today account. And this has a subsequent referral to Transportation and Economic Development.
Okay, we have a, can I get a motion? Representative Matthews, the guy on the spot today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2919 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill will be referred to Transportation and Economic Development.
Representative Matthews moves House Bill 2919 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Transportation and Economic Development. Any discussion? Any objection? So be it. Smooth. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2919. Okay, we'll go back into an informational hearing. And I believe we're having one from Director Willis and Mr. Mann.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to thank the committee for allowing us to come today and share some information regarding veterans benefits and veterans housing. As you know, the United States Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki has set a goal of ending veteran homelessness in 5 years. Nationally, 75,609 veterans were homeless during a one-night homeless count in 2009. An estimated 136,000 veterans spent at least one night in an emergency shelter or transitional housing unit. The United States Department of Veterans Affairs estimates that Oregon has about 3,000 homeless veterans. During the 2010 one-night homeless count, the Housing and Community Services Department reports finding 565 homeless veterans. You can see the difference between these two numbers. It illustrates the difficulty of providing services to homeless veterans. They are transitory. They often do not self-identify themselves as veterans, and more often do not want to be counted in such government reports. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is committed to helping these homeless veterans transition to self-sufficiency. And we do this in several ways. The first one is outreach. We work with Oregon Housing and Community Services, the County Veteran Service Officers, a number of nonprofits, and the Oregon Congressional Delegation, and others who are interested in reaching out to homeless veterans and let them know about the potential benefits, including transitional housing vouchers from the federal VA. Also, we work with regard to these homeless veterans with regard to their VA, their earned VA benefits. We want them to apply for their VA disability and health care benefits, and should they be eligible for their disability compensation or pension, they would then receive monetary compensation from the VA, which they can then use to pay rent, buy food, and transition to independence. Also, we work with what's called a stand-down. Some of you have had these in your districts. They're very effective because it allows us to provide services to homeless veterans right where they are. And these services include free medical examinations, clothing, haircuts, sleeping bags, field jackets, boots, gloves, food, VA benefit counseling, legal aid, and as I mentioned before, the health care to include mental health outreach. Now, I said a moment ago that Eric Shinseki, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, has vowed to end veterans' homelessness in 5 years. While we fully support that effort, we have identified some barriers that need to be removed before that happens here in Oregon. As with any state, there will always be resources in large cities, more resources in large cities than in smaller areas, especially in rural and remote areas. The largest barrier to ending veteran homelessness in Oregon is the lack of available transitional housing, especially outside the Portland metro area. The Federal Veterans Affairs provides housing vouchers, but no matter how many they give Oregon, if they don't have the beds or a place to stay, the vouchers cannot be used. Even in Portland, the demand outpaces the supply of beds, and many veterans with vouchers cannot use them. To end homelessness for veterans, Oregon will have to increase the supply of veteran transitional housing beds. Another barrier is the mental health needs of the veterans. Simply put, many have mental health and/or drug and alcohol abuse issues, which often prohibit them from taking advantage of programs that otherwise would help them transition to independence. And I want to add something outside my testimony about that. The reason that the mental health and drug and alcohol are an issue with the available transition beds is because the vast majority of them require that the person be completely clean before they would be admitted to the bed. That, of course, in the case of these veterans, is not achievable. They're not clean. And another barrier may surprise you, and by the way, I'm going to come back to that issue as to what a solution might be. The other barrier that might surprise you is that some veterans simply do not want to transition. They like their lifestyle and they will not come in. In fact, there are veterans receiving disability compensation or pension from the VA who pick up their checks at a mailbox drop close to where they're staying in a homeless state. They will cash their checks and return to the woods. I met a group of these veterans when I was at the Eugene Stand Down, which was located at the National Guard Armory just outside or just adjacent to, at that time, Autzen Stadium. Many of the veterans were milling around on the inside of the armory, taking advantage of the things I just discussed, the free food, the medical aid, haircuts, dental examinations, and so on. But out back, in the alley behind the armory, were the veterans I just described, the ones who live in the woods and who, in some cases, are living communally for their own protection, the vast majority of which were Vietnam vets. All of them now in their 60s, but so angry with the United States government that they won't enter a government facility, they don't want anything from the government, and the only thing they were waiting for at that entire stand down was for the clothing supply to open. That's all they wanted. And as soon as it did, as it turned out, they had a lookout or a scout that was standing near where the door was, where the clothing was, and as soon as that got ready to open, he gave the signal, and they were the first in line. They got what they needed, and they vanished. Now, people have a hard time understanding how could people want to live like that. And I can simply tell you from being in that generation, and some people here are also in that generation, that there are those who will simply never forgive this country for how they were treated, and who have developed an almost paranoid response to their lack of trust in anything government, which, by the way, includes the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, because we are the government. So, reaching out to these veterans is the right thing to do, but I want you to understand that no matter how hard we try, there is a small percentage of these folks that are not going to come in until they're too sick to stay out, and that's when we see them. And that's when we get them admitted to the VA hospital or to an outpatient clinic for care. Now, I've given a lot of thought regarding about how to make a positive difference for the homeless veterans who want to transition to independence. An idea that I'm pursuing is to build housing based on the Oxford House model. Many of you know about Oxford houses because they're literally in every county in this state. In an Oxford house, members are required to be employed, to pay their share of the expenses, including rent, and be part of a self-governing democracy within the house with the other residents. My idea is to create liberty houses in which veterans will receive help finding employment, obtain veterans benefits, and within a reasonable amount of time be able to pay their fair share of the expenses. They could stay in these houses up to 3 years while they work on issues such as mental health, drug and alcohol addictions, or other barriers to their success, to include something as simple as the ability to create or the ability to fill out a job application or complete a professional resume. The cost is significantly lower than transitional homeless housing. Beds cost approximately $2.50 per night in the Oxford House, as opposed to $24 to $60 a night in other like facilities. Obviously, we would need help from our federal partners to embark on such a project, but I can envision Oregon becoming a pilot state to build male and female veteran Liberty homes, and I believe that model would be quite successful. I want to go off my testimony and tell you that I sat down on two different occasions with the Oxford House executives at the state level, one of whom was an amazing individual who was himself a graduate of the Oxford House program, having been about as far down and out as you could possibly get, came through the program, earned a baccalaureate degree, and is now the number two guy in the whole Oxford House program in the state. And when he told me the rules of the Oxford House, it was clear to me that some of our veterans, both men and women, who we would want to set up these various houses for, couldn't qualify for an Oxford House, because of their very stringent rules on drug and alcohol abuse. As an example, you cannot even be on antabuse in an Oxford house. We have many veterans who are on antabuse working their way out of an alcohol addiction. So in a Liberty house, we would probably do a construct that would be slightly different from the Oxford house. And understand, please, that a Liberty house is veteran only, and that much as the Oxford House has homes just for women, we would do the same thing. We would have Liberty homes just for women veterans and then ones for male veterans as well. In the meantime, while we work with our federal partners to develop such a program, Oregon's struggle will be the availability of transitional housing, especially in rural and remote Oregon. And I want to again go off my testimony and tell you about a wonderful place in Central Oregon, in Bend, that's operated by the Central Oregon Veterans Outreach folks, that's called the Home of the Brave. The Home of the Brave is a transitional housing project for five people. It's just five people at a time. But it stands, it gives these people the opportunity to do exactly what we're talking about here. Transition from homelessness and maybe addictive behaviors into a job, into their own home, and standing up and paying their taxes and moving on with their life. This has worked so successfully that recently they opened a duplex for women and their children, women veterans and their children. So it can be done, and recently another home was opened in Hillsboro, which also uses that same kind of a model of transitional housing. So I think these Oxford House-style programs, where you're looking at anywhere from 5 to 25 beds scattered around the state in remote and rural areas, urban and metro, is really the way to go to offset some of these larger programs that are already in place in some of our metro counties and in our Mid-Valley corridor counties. So I'm just telling you that we will continue to reach out to these homeless veterans and work with them to ensure they receive all the benefits they earn through their military service, which includes the opportunity to transition from homelessness to self-sufficiency. The Federal Department of Veterans Affairs and others who grant the grant assistance and the vouchers for this transitional housing do this through nonprofits. So the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs could not apply for and receive these grants. But what we could do is set up these governing bodies, similar again to the Oxford Houses, that we create these homes around our state with lots and lots of supportive people, to include veterans organizations, who want to find a way to help the veterans in their area. And just recently, I saw a presentation by the Gospel Mission right here in Salem that talked about what they're doing with regard to homelessness and so on. But they're not really the transitional housing that we're talking about here. They're a warming center in some cases. In other cases, someone's there for a couple of days and then they move on and maybe move to the next mission down the line and so on and so forth. But we look at all these programs because we'd like to take the best that all of them do, then roll them in, have a model for what we're calling, or what we're trying to call, the Liberty House, and then launch it in one or more spots around our state, and then refine it, and then duplicate it, just like they did with the Oxford Houses. So we can do it. And I just wanted the committee to know what we're working on. There's lots of projects we're working on, but that's one of them. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Co-Chair Escobar and Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee.
Thank you, Director Willis. I would like you, if you would, share the suicidal rate on the Vietnam veterans, because you shocked me in my office.
Yeah.
I believe that was yesterday.
Yes, sir.
It's
well,
unbelievable.
During the war that both Representative Escobar and I served in, we lost over 58,000 of our brothers and sisters who were killed in that war. When we pulled the combat troops out of Vietnam on March 30th, 1973, from March 30th, 1973 until today, we've lost over 130,000 of our brothers and sisters who have taken their own life. It's tragic, absolutely tragic. And part of that is because of what I just testified about a moment ago, about that generation who, in many cases, suffered from absolute hopelessness. and use dependency on drug and alcohol to make it through their lives. That led, of course, to many other illnesses, and finally led to the despair that causes people to take the decision to end their life. So it is a shocking number. And those of us who are in that generation and those of us who have studied what's happening in the current generation are worried to death that this could repeat itself without the awareness campaigns that we've already discussed in front of the committee. So thank you, Representative Escoval, for letting me bring that information to the committee.
Thank you, Director Rolls. Any comments? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. It's funny you mentioned the Oxford House model.
Right.
You know, Mark and I have talked about that a lot as well. What does that look like, and how does that apply, and kind of independently of anything that's coming out of the National Guard? But it's such an interesting model, and it works. And
yes,
these folks who go in and out of Oxford Houses and have the time to get their life straightened out. I think that same model applied to the veterans community. The community response that you could get out of something like that, where some of these Oxford houses have the additional expense of furnishing the houses and things like that. And I think if we could simply get some of these houses in our pipeline, some of that, how do you furnish it and how do you maintain it and who mows the lawn? And I think based on who you're housing there, you're going to get some community support, and particularly in rural communities where you have women's groups and Lions clubs and all these kind of things who
yeah.
do that work. And, I hate to see money be a factor. You didn't mention what your estimates on cost are and whatnot, but we also have this kind of parallel tragic thing that's happened in the housing market where we have a lot of depressed housing prices. I mean, I think if you're talking about a model like this, now's the time to be talking about that before home prices go back up again, because you could probably double the inventory, which you could have had if you have a budget pool in mind, based on the fact that, particularly Central Oregon, rural Oregon, where those housing prices are, still have actually some opportunity, and bad opportunity, but they're potentially going to fall some more. If there was ever a time to try to engage in this model, it's now, why the housing prices are what they are.
Well, Co-Chair Escoval and Co-Chair Witt, Representative Parrish, you're exactly correct. And that's how the Central Oregon Group was able to acquire the homes that they are currently using, was because of the depressed economy, but also because the community realized that it's better to have these people in a structured environment, which, by the way, they control. So if you're going to act out in that environment, you're going to have to face your fellow housemates, because that's who is going to impose the standard of behavior. And that's what happened in the Oxford program. That's what's happening in these veterans programs. Also, I totally agree with you that when you go to the community to talk to them about this program, just like the Oxford House people have, when they first began, it won't surprise any member of the committee that there were people in various communities where the Oxford houses are located who said, great idea, but not in my backyard. That's changed. And I can tell you from personal experience, right out my back door and right across the street where I live is an Oxford house with 20 beds. I couldn't have better neighbors. I'm going to tell you that right now. These people have wonderful celebrations when someone graduates and moves out and gets their own place and has their job, has their car, and has stepped away from the challenges that brought them to the home in the first place. I think we can do the same thing with the Liberty Houses for men and women veterans, and we're going to work hard to make that happen.
Any other questions or comments?
Director Willis?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Whip.
Jim, I'm trying to understand the veterans who are on the outside and led to believe that we have a camp in Columbia County, principally Vietnam veterans as well.
Right.
And I know that you said that generally speaking, most of these folks are on the outside because of a complete and utter distrust of government and how they were treated. And my question is, this distrust, when did that occur? Was it when they were in theater, or did it take place when they failed to have adequate reintegration?
I think Chair Escoval and Co-Chair Witt, the vast majority of it occurred after they came home, and how they were treated, both with regard to their service and the lack of services. We forget, as we're sitting here in 2011, with world-class health care from the VA, and it is. It's hard to get. It takes a while to get in line and get in there, but once you do, you won't get better health care. That was not the case in the late 60s and on into the 70s. It was dismal care. So that was a failure. And the employment of these folks was very difficult too, Representative Witt, because there became a label which was placed across the board that was entitled Crazy Vietnam Veteran. Mm-hmm. And here you had people who served with great dignity and great honor that didn't deserve to be labeled like that at all. But when that happens to you enough times, then you start to look for someone to blame. And that someone is the person who sent you in the first place, and that's the United States government.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions, comments? It's always a pleasure, Director Willis, to have you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Anything for the benefit of the order? Comments? Seeing none?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I do have one.
You didn't? I didn't see the appendage up.
I had a visit with a somebody from, anyway, foster care is the subject. And we were talking about the potential of getting higher ed benefits. There's a bill out there that would allow foster kids that age out to be able to go in to higher ed and have balance of their tuition paid that's not covered by Pell Grants and other things. And one of the young ladies that was there talking to me, I said, how many could qualify maybe for parents' veterans benefits, for example? That, you know, there are benefits out there where if a parent, a veteran parent is 100% disabled or deceased, that their dependents could qualify for benefits. And she said that her father had passed away 6 years ago. She was a minor and didn't have another parent. She was put into the foster care system. When she went into the foster care system, she became a ward of the state, which she claims she has been told by two veteran services officers that the government does not acknowledge her as a veterans dependent anymore. They acknowledge her as a dependent of the state. And I thought that was really crappy for this young lady, that she gets caught up in a system that we've created and doesn't have the benefits that I think most of us up here at the dais would think just naturally. Sure, she's truly a child of a dependent of a veteran and a deceased veteran, but yet she doesn't qualify for some of those. So she's, in a sense, I think she would categorize it like this also, she's going out and begging for benefits in other ways that, you know, she probably should qualify for otherwise. So I just wanted to say that and share it with you and maybe put our heads together. And I don't know if Tom or anybody could...
Yeah, Representative, maybe I could ask Mr. Mann to step up here, or Director Willis or someone. Maybe we could research this out, get back to the committee and let us know what the status is, because that's just wrong.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I have a little background on this, having gone through the foster care system. You are a ward of the court until you are either an emancipated minor, because you can emancipate yourself once you're out of high school, or you turn 18 years old and get out of that system. You would not lose the veteran benefit from a deceased parent or 100% service-connected disabled parent after you get out of the system. But as a ward of the court, that's correct. You're kind of like chattel in the old language you used to use in statute. The state owns you. You are their ward. You're no longer the veteran or the spouse's responsibility. They're no longer your guardian legally. So what I would tell that student is, as you're preparing to transition from your foster care, you need to connect back up with the veteran service officer so we can reestablish those benefits, because once you're emancipated from that system, once again, those parental benefits can be applied.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Mr. Chair.
Sure.
And I did encourage her. We were talking about the campus veteran service officer program and encouraged her to check back a third time, not knowing how long it has been since she checked. And I said, you know, maybe things have changed in your age or benefits or whatever. So, but I thought that was an interesting dynamic, that if you're at the right age, you're kind of caught in a conundrum there.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Huffman, I just encourage you to send her to us. Be happy to talk with her and work on that issue.
Thank you.
Anything else? Representative Witt,
Co-Chair Witt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to let the folks know, particularly the good folks over in Central Oregon who formed the Band of Brothers, and who have advanced the memorial for Mr. Belfoil. I think that's close to the proper pronunciation, that we will be hearing that a week from today. We've received a fair amount of inquiries about that, and so I just wanted all the good people out there who've written in behalf of him to know that we're going to be hearing about his efforts during World War II in the Pacific Theater.
Thank you. Co-Chair Witt. I just wanted to let the committee know that I've been talking with Oregon Department of Veterans on ODVA loans. And what my objective is to redo that program so it's parallel with the federal program. 100% funded, can utilize it throughout their lives, and the veteran continues to grow assets in that program with the deduction of anything that they've used. Example, in 1972 or 71 or something like that, I purchased with my federal VA a house for, I think, $14,000, which is a lot of money in those days, and sold it later, but I still had $14,000, but my level of eligibility still kept growing, minus this $14,000. And that's what I'd like to see us do, because it's such a great program. It gets a great rate. But more importantly, I'd like to see us incorporate to help veterans when they're coming in out of the theater, out of Iraq or Afghanistan, to be able to have the ability to refi their house through ODVA. Because right now that's prohibited, and I think that it's a great tool for our veterans to keep them from not losing their houses, especially with the amount of unemployment that we seem to experience with our veterans. So I am working on those with the Department of Veteran Affairs. So, anything else for the good of the order?
Yes,
Representative Matthews.
Thank you. Well, everybody's taking a shot. I might as well, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I think as we continue to hear things, you know, we had the reintegration committee that we worked on, and thank you, Mr. Willis, Mr. Mann, particularly, great job on that. But we just have an opportunity, I think, to really kind of set the standard for the nation, and that is trying to get our veterans recognized for the experience they have. And it's I know it's complicated. Every military trains to a different standard, it seems, in different trades. But ultimately, you know, our veterans, yes, they need to go to school and have those in place. But a lot of these folks, you know, our veterans are, they're citizen soldiers. They come back. They want to get back to work. They don't necessarily have time to reengage in school. And they've been doing a job now for X amount of years. And I use the point of emergency medical services because that's, you know, my forte being a firefighter. But we had a bill last session that we actually started getting there with DHS to loosen that up a little, because Oregon was the only state for the last 14 years that required a two-year degree to be a paramedic. But they advised me that we were the leaders in that, but I reminded them you're only leading if somebody's following you. But the bottom line is that our veterans currently, we can have a combat medic in the theater of war bandaging soldiers, and that's okay, but they can't be an EMT basic in the field in their own hometown. And we've got to get better. We've got to find a way, not only in medical service, but all of our trades and all of our labor fields, because our veterans, they're highly skilled, they're highly trained, and they're not being recognized for a two-year degree because they don't have that. They've got 2 years of solid hands-on experience doing these trades, and we really need to bring them back into the trade union and or and trade labor, get them out there working, and get these folks you know, back into salary and family wage jobs and get them back out here productive in the community and help with reintegration. So that's all I have to say about that, Mr. Chair, but thanks for the opportunity as always, and great job running this committee. It's a pleasure serving with you.
Well, and I'm going to give you a great example. A fellow that I grew up with went into the Air Force, was a hydraulics, basically an expert in the Air Force on Phantoms, F-4, I think it was E's in those days, in the old days. But he came out, had no recognition in school whatsoever on that, but now designs hydraulics for mills and wood products, as well as bullet manufacturers and everything. He designs systems, and he learned all that from the United States Air Force. So a lot of validity there, Representative Lyons. Anything else? If not, we'll adjourn.